From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the Jack and Spike Show.
Welcome to the Jack and Spike Show. I'm Spike O'Neill. Jack Stein's taking a day today to regroup his mental and physical capabilities. Man gives it all, leaves it on the field. Mike Lewis joining us today. Mike, thanks for coming in. Good to see you, my friend.
Happy to be here.
Right on. So we're talking about today. Let's see. Oh, well, of course, the deadline for former President Trump to pay the New York City fine is looming overhead. And the wheels are in motion of all parties to try to either avoid the 454. Is it 54 now? Because it increases $100,000+ a day.
Yes.
In interest. Yeah. We have updates on that. But first, let's talk about the big news that isn't news. The government shutdown that probably won't happen now. Government was facing a midnight deadline tonight, right, to keep essential services funded and avoid the 22nd government shutdown in the last 50 years. I had no idea it was that common to shut down the government.
Once it became standard as a leverage, the way the government is funded used to be something that wasn't actually part of the whole
circus?
No, so the partisan circus existed, but it usually existed, and you traded back and forth on setting the budget. And then once you got there, you kind of pushed it all the way through. So the trading happened earlier in the situation. Now the trading happens at the end of the situation, which is why we always run into this shutdown thing. I think this is a permanent feature of government at this particular point. It's not anymore going to be something that we are surprised about. And in this particular case,
this would be the first Biden shutdown. If they don't get their act together. So earlier, this morning that the House passed by a supermajority?
Last night.
A supermajority voted for, with a minority of Republican reps voting for this budget, mostly Democratic votes. But the supermajority means that the government doesn't have to, the House doesn't have to take these things through various committees. No. They can bypass a lot of procedures. And that's where people, the extremes of the party, both parties, fight for their side, fight for their defund this or throw in that.
Well, and the one of the things that I think that, obviously these sort of things get everyone worked up, the people who are paying attention get worked up. The rest, everyone else just chooses, I think, to ignore it.
Right.
But. In one small sense, this actually is government, or at least at the political end of government, functioning as it should, because what the existing very short-term bill does or did was cull the extremes in both parties.
Right.
All the progressives got culled because they did not support it because there was not humanitarian aid for Gaza, mm-hmm, for one reason. The far right, who didn't feel that this thing was addressing government spending in a manner that they saw fit, they voted against it. And so that sort of thing is kind of the way government should actually function.
Through compromise. Right.
Well,
and trade-offs
because
negotiations.
So in a weird way, I mean, I'm not saying that this is an uplifting moment, but I am saying that it definitely is something that actually is government functioning as it should, even though what people read is shut down.
Now, former Speaker McCarthy lost his speakership because of the fringe of his party.
Right.
Thought that his compromise, working across the aisle with Democrats in the House to come up with a budget, was a bridge too far.
Right.
And he was voted out.
Right.
Well, since Mike Johnson has reached across the aisle, worked with Democrats, avoided a government shutdown, now Marjorie Taylor Greene, no big surprise here, has already filed motions to have the Speaker vacate his seat.
Right.
Right out of the gate.
Right. And so what she didn't do is file the
The
privileged motion.
Right.
I was searching for the word. The privileged motion, which means that it goes to a vote immediately.
Right.
So what is she telling you? Well, she's telling you she's irritated. No news there. but she's also telling you, I don't have the votes. This is what she's telling you. Because if she had the votes, she would have done it right away. So the fact is, what she's trying to do is now put in motion over the next 2 weeks, because they're going to be gone.
Right, spring break.
Exactly.
Well, Easter break. I apologize. They're not going to be partying in Lauderdale.
What they're going to be discussing what the ramifications of this exactly is and whether or not she and her cohorts can actually squirrel together enough votes to push him out and then find, I don't get it. Like, he is about as far right as you can be. I don't know how much farther right you can be. So I don't know who they're going to find out there, because everyone right now knows that as soon as you get this job, you've got a bullseye.
Well, we've got audio, I believe, of Representative Green. I'm not sure. I want to be respectful, because it's so easy not to with MTG. Nora, could you play that for us?
Again, I have paid all of my dues to the NRCC and then some. I support Republicans holding the majority next conference, but we need a Speaker of the House that knows how to negotiate, knows how to walk in the room, knows how to hold the line, and knows how to defend America first.
Knows how to negotiate and knows how to hold the line. So I'm not saying those are directly contradictory statements, mm-hmm. but what she's saying is you're not asking for someone who negotiates. What you're asking for is someone who doesn't
negotiate.
You've got someone who negotiates.
Right. Someone who surrenders to the tantrum of the minority of your party.
Right.
Now, I know there was a majority of Republicans who didn't vote against this or who didn't vote for this
right.
particular budget proposal. But the way that this speakership is structured under the same guidelines that Kevin McCarthy fell under is that one person can call for a vote to,
yep.
to vacate the seat.
Yeah, enjoy that.
You know, it's like you're taking your family to Disney in the car and you got the one brat in the back who will not, okay, we're going to Stuckey's World instead.
Right.
You know, you don't get to grab the front wheel
no.
of the party by a fringe. And I think this is a great sign from Speaker Johnson that he's going to weather, I hope he weathers the storm here. Because like you said, she doesn't have the votes. That's why she didn't make it a privileged motion to vacate.
Precisely. I mean, you know, and that should probably be included in the story. If she had it, she would have done it. And she doesn't at this particular point. And I think that, you know, the one thing, if you are in favor of the government spending on this particular bill, you may not be. But if you are or want to see it move ahead or just want to stop dealing with it, one of the good things happening here is that it's an election year. And I know that there's not a lot of things about election year that make anyone very excited. But there is a liability to a government shutdown. It's going to primarily be a liability for the party creating the shutdown. From a electorate standpoint. And so this is something that they don't even want. I think many people in their party really don't want, especially with the, and we'll talk about this later, the fundraising gap.
Right.
They don't want to get involved in a lengthy shutdown because no one is going to come out of that unbruised, but it's going to really bruise the GOP.
Well, there was reports that when Green proposed this motion to vacate, she was swarmed by her Republican colleagues on the floor asking her not to do this
yep.
because it makes them look like they can't
yep.
govern.
Yep.
And it's just total chaos. And as you mentioned, this is an election year.
Right.
And that doesn't play well with the electorate.
No, I mean, I think this is going to be, I think the one thing working in the Biden administration's favor in this is the fact that there's an election coming up and the Republicans have to do a fair bit of work to show that they are the party that should govern. Now, they do have a candidate who's still polling quite well. So that is going to help, and that has the long tail effect on other GOP candidates. But this thing is something that even honestly, if you're part of the Trump campaign or a Trump supporter, you should probably not be rooting for a government shutdown at this point.
So you mentioned fundraising. Let's dovetail into that topic because the fundraising numbers for the GOP as opposed to the Democrats in general, let alone Trump or Biden,
right.
numbers are horrific.
Numbers aren't good, but and in fact, Biden's outraising them by you know, a magnitude of two at this particular point. I mean, it's like a tremendous difference. However, if you are in favor of the current administration and the current administration being perpetuated through the next election, I would offer one word of caution. $200 million. $200 million is how much Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump.
And lost. Yeah, but
and I would say to everyone, like, sometimes it's not solely about how much money you raise, but what sort of campaign you run and then your overall popularity.
Well, that being said, the RNC has now issued a statement last night saying that the former president's legal bills would serve priority over senatorial and congressional races.
You know, from one particular fund within the RNC controls.
How's that going to affect down ballot tickets?
I mean, if I'm a candidate, I am both happy to latch my, you know, my rail car to the Trump locomotive. On the other hand, you do need actual money to run an actual campaign, and not getting that money from the national organization is not going to help you especially if you're running in a purplish district for Congress. That money is vital for you to get over the hump, especially given, again, as we said earlier, the Democrats' overall leverage now, given their fundraising, how much fundraising they've been doing.
Right on. So, staying on the topic of former President Trump, because he earns free media, to your point about, you know, not having Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump in 16 yeah. by $200 million. But Trump's media coverage was almost 2-1 over Hillary Clinton because he does garner attention and knows how to command a camera.
Yep.
So as we move forward in this, I'm lost my train of thought and I apologize. I wanted to get to this and I'm...
On Truth Social, the Truth Social
yes,
merger?
Yes, thank you.
The
former president may have a lifeline with regard to his civil suit in New York.
Right.
That Truth Social is going public. They announced yesterday.
Yep. And he's going to potentially, he's going to be a 60% owner. That's going to be from a stock valuation standpoint, not sort of phony money until it's cashed in. It's about $3.3 billion. It's a lot of money. The thing about a stock valuation, even though you pay heavy on, well, I guess not if you're super wealthy of any political persuasion, but ostensibly you pay a lot in capital gains tax when you sell that stock. What happens though is the stock becomes something that you actually just borrow against. And that's usually that would be what happens here, although that'll take some time for him to realize that money. But there is one thing that's very, very clear. And you sort of touched on this just a couple of minutes ago. Trump is not great from a historical standpoint at real estate. He is phenomenal at social media. Like, weirdly enough, the thing that he is most known for,
right, what's his empire
not
built
he
on?
Has he
yeah.
is loaded with debt. He couldn't produce enough money to pay off his damages in New York. Yet he gets like these windfalls, and he gets them largely from the back in the day from TV stuff. He was making more money on that than he was in real estate.
Yeah, his apprentice money was phenomenal.
Was phenomenal. And that's kind of why he ran for president, because he was actually at that time negotiating a big contract with CBS. Ends up winning, and then everything changes. So I think right now what he is acutely aware of is that he needs to hammer away on the social media end of his business, because that's the area where he is making a lot of money. And the real estate and the business, while that is what sort of established his reputation and made him a famous guy in New York and all of that, that those properties are not doing anywhere near as well, and they're laden with debt. And so, oddly, you know, all of that's the Art of the Deal book should just be rewritten, replacing real estate with social media, because he actually is quite good at that.
So he'll have billions at his of resources once this goes public and the stock is valuated, but he can't sell that stock for 6 months.
Right.
And they're going public on the New York Stock Exchange on Monday morning, I believe it is.
Yeah.
And that's
an early stock valuation. I mean, as we know from stock valuations, they can change pretty rapidly.
Yeah, but we're not talking that it's worth $600 million and he needs five. It's worth $3 billion and he needs $500 million. So it should be plenty there. But again, can he borrow against it? Is that going to be the lifeline he needs by Monday morning? Because, you know, the deadline, the countdown has been in the news everywhere nonstop for the last week or so. That, as you mentioned, the former president can't secure bonds of insurance
right.
from 30 different countries,
right.
or companies, I should say. That's another part of this that scares the crap
exactly.
out of me, is countries. Yesterday, the New York's attorney general and the judge in that particular New York civil case issued issued paperwork that says that they want to know where former President Trump, if he is able to secure a bond and eliminate or at least put off the seizure of his properties. They don't want to know exactly where that money is coming from.
Right.
The what's the word I'm looking for? The person who's in charge of overseeing
they appoint an auditor.
An auditor. Thank you. Okay.
So for the money as it comes in, because they don't want undue influence, particularly from foreign governments,
right.
from certain corporations, things like that. They pay a lot of attention to that. They pay a lot of attention to that in regular campaign raising, much less in something like this. And so it's going to be interesting, because it's not going to be like, you know, the sovereign fund from Saudi Arabia
right,
is going to be able to jump
that
in.
That's the case, yeah.
Right, that they're going to jump in and do this. Now, what usually will happen in this, in some form of corporate money laundering, what usually happens is someone buys an overvalued property, and suddenly that money then is moved into, you know, the fund that is going to pay back the fines. I mean, that kind of stuff, even if it's being tracked, could be entirely legal in a way of doing this. They're probably looking at all avenues right now of getting this thing, getting the bond funded.
One thing that New York Attorney General Letitia James yesterday filed a motion that says they want to know, because Trump's attorneys have said they reached out to 30 different insuring companies. They want to know who they reached out to, what the details were of what property they put forth as collateral, why the companies turned them down. They want verification and paperwork on all that stuff. To make sure that the president isn't getting money from a source that's that well, puts the, that compromises and puts the country in a weird position.
I mean, a couple of things on that, right? I mean, first, a lot of these properties, I don't know about, I mean, I don't know that this has ever been reported. Rather, I don't know that the extent of this has been reported, but it's what is widely known is that a lot of these properties do carry a lot of debt. And so going like second and third mortgage deep is something insurance companies are like, maybe I'm not so interested. But the other thing is that they also know that a lot of this valuation from Truth Social mm-hmm. to the man himself is contingent upon this election. And so why on earth would you jump forward with a whole bunch of money when that money is going to become a lot less likely to be paid back if November doesn't turn out the way the Trump folks want it to turn out? And if it doesn't turn out like that, that's going to be a whole lot of debt with a whole lot of people looking for to be first in line to collect.
Right. And the New York State's lien or their fine against Trump's business practices for the decades of fraud that were established in a court of law through Judge Edgeron. The Trump legal team is nonstop blasted the validity of these charges, of the verdict, of the play, all the players involved.
So can I defend Trump's legal team for just a minute?
Sure, sure.
So the thing that bothers me about this, I mean, I don't mind them going after, any business person who does this sort of ridiculous overvaluing of property mm-hmm. and then gets loans based on that. That's fraud. There's no question about that. What bothers me is that it has been done so aggressively. I mean, when Trump's team has defended the practices, this is standard in this business. What everyone should be focused on is why is this standard in this business and why are these laws never enforced? And that is a problem. They're enforcing it correctly with Trump.
Right.
But my goodness, like there are so many people who do this as a course of business, especially in big real estate deals here in Seattle. And the idea that somehow this is something that is not regular business practice is actually incorrect. It is consistently regular business practice. Now, I'm not defending.
No, I hear you.
I'm happy about the investigation, but when they say they feel singled out, I think that they have fairly good reason to feel singled out because this has been an open secret in big real estate development in the East Coast, West Coast, all over the planet for a long, long time.
And people, I agree with you, but people would push back just because it's everyone's doing it doesn't mean it's not illegal. I know, and you led with that, and I appreciate that. All right, when we come back, this is the Jack and Spike Show. Mike Lowe sitting in for Jack Stein. When we come back, we're going to take a look at Apple's legal troubles with the federal government and 15 different states, including Washington. It's the Jack and Spike Show. We'll be right back after this. Back to the Jack and Spike Show. Our YouTube channel, the Jack and Spike Show, has constantly updated digital content. We'll have more there today and out throughout the course of the weekend. Give us a shot. Give us a feedback. We'd love to hear from you. Mike Lewis is in today for Jack Stein. Mike, we haven't talked about this all week as the story's been building, and I want to rely on your technical savvy to help me understand this story.
All right.
It's the Apple lawsuit story. And what I hear from the headlines is that the Attorney General of America, Merrick Garland, mm-hmm. is partnering with 15 different state AGs, attorneys 16. General. 16? Yeah. Okay. Including Washington.
So, actually, oddly, no.
No, okay.
I mean,
I'm wrong from the get. That's why I'm glad you're here.
But that would be, when has Bob Ferguson not seen a lawsuit he didn't like?
So it's not Washington.
Washington is not a, well, I mean, Washington, everyone in Washington would be, should there be a settlement and they are an iPhone owner, they would be part
they
of
would, it. They would benefit from any
they
kind
they potentially
judgment.
Could benefit okay. from it. And certainly if you're a developer who has been fighting with Apple, you and your local business, again, you could benefit from this.
But you're right. When has Bob Ferguson not met a lawsuit he didn't like?
I actually reflexively just assumed it was. And then I just bothered to go back earlier and actually look at the court document itself, which is super well written. It's actually kind of this great lesson in why and what antitrust law is and why it effectively targets, why the government has targeted Apple in this particular case. It really is like, it's not, doesn't read like a standard legal document. It actually reads sort of like a kind of a well-told story about Apple and the way Apple's done its business. I mean, it's a one-sided story, mind you. It's just the government. But nonetheless, it's pretty well done. And I'm looking through it and I think, like, I just was like, well, Washington must be lower. And no, and I keep going down through all the states that are involved. Oregon's there. California is there. California, the state where Apple is.
Yeah.
And there's no Washington. And I'm like, did they just miss the call?
Is it Ferguson's campaign having to do running for governor?
No,
he doesn't want to
want
to tick off his constituents who are Apple.
I can't imagine anyone. Yeah. I mean, every single one of these 16 states has elections going on, and they didn't seem to have it. And this is a state where Ferguson will probably win easily. You know, not even by double digit percentage points potentially. I mean, it depends on how well Dave Reichert does, but nonetheless, I can't imagine that. I was just like, I'm going to go back and double check that because I was so surprised to see Washington not involved in this anyway. But that's not really what we're talking about.
So what's the suit alleging?
So the suit is alleging. So if you are antitrust law in the United States is essentially built on this idea that if you are dominant in a market and you can manipulate that market to your own advantage at the expense of potentially consumers or other businesses, the government can step in and say, hey, this is you own too much of this. That when the government broke up Ma Bell way back in the day, that was into seven big companies. And that actually opened up the door for Sprint and other cellular
lower
companies.
Prices,
it did a whole bunch of stuff.
Earning people's business.
You know, more than 100 years ago, Standard Oil was the same thing. Owned most of the oil to gasoline refining in the United States that they stepped in and sort of said, look, you own so much in the market. You literally are like a nation unto yourself. And that doesn't work under our structure of government and under our structure of our economy.
And I know I'm going to ask you a question that's more of a legal question. I know you're a tech guy. But I'm not sure you're a legal expert, but I'm asking anyway. Does the government need for there to be a consumer element to this to have an antitrust? Can it just be business to business? Does antitrust apply when it's just businesses that are being harmed by a monopoly? Or do consumers have to be affected as well?
That is a very, very, very good question. And that answer is unclear. So originally antitrust law was based on this idea of competitive practices among businesses. When Standard Oil bought up most of the oil available in the United States from an oil well standpoint, the government stepped in and said, can't do that anymore. It has since evolved into this other thing being like, well, sure, someone can have a market dominance that could potentially be monopolistic, but does it hurt the consumer? And this is where Facebook and Google, for two examples, and perhaps Apple as a third, have sort of slid past, because if the consumer is not harmed, is there any harm? I mean, that's essentially that's what the legal standard is. And Google, let's use Google as an example. Gmail is free.
Mm-hmm.
Google Docs are free.
Right.
I mean, Microsoft may not be happy about it because it certainly cut into their business.
Yeah.
But the fact is, and Facebook is what? Free. And so if the consumers aren't harmed, is there any harm? In the modern DOJ, Biden administration DOJ, led by Jonathan Cantor, who was part of the Attorney General's office, who was actually the antitrust head.
Okay.
He and some other folks are trying to return to that original, like, hey, even if it doesn't hurt the consumer, and you could argue differently about Apple, let's say. Even if it doesn't hurt the consumer, it still matters from a competitive business standpoint. Like, what we want is a thriving economy of choice. That really is sort of an underpinning of what you want in capitalism. And so is market dominance, even that doesn't hurt a consumer, is that a bad thing for an economy? And the DOJ in this particular case would say yes. Now, what they're talking about with Apple is Apple so tightly controls the ecosystem. It makes other smartwatches perform poorly. Everyone knows the blue and green blue and green bubble. The whole idea that they make other messaging, Android-based messaging effectively, not function as well. Like, you can't move videos, you can't do all this stuff. And Tim Cook, they literally have Tim Cook at a conference joking and saying, when someone says, hey, what do I tell my mom when she can't see the videos of the grandkids when I send it to her on her Android phone? He said, well, why don't you just buy her an iPhone? And weirdly enough, they're using that in this lawsuit against it, because he's essentially saying, hey, sorry, we're not here to help you. You need to buy our product to be able to get this whole ecosystem. That's fine when the iPhone first came out, and it was one of many. But the iPhone is such a dominant phone. This is the thing that you go back to in anytime you hear antitrust, think about this. What is the market? And this is not there's no sort of like, There's no way to assess that in a way that everyone agrees. Apple would argue in this particular case that there are all kinds of, there's cheap, there's $50 phones, there's burner phones, there's a lot of, there's your grandparents' jitterbug phone. There's a lot of phones out there. We're just a phone maker.
Right.
The government would say, no, you are the dominant phone maker. There's 1 billion people who have purchased these things, and your ability to control an entire world, like from the apps, third-party apps that are used, to Apple Pay, which takes a cut every time you spend money, to all of these things, you have essentially established such dominance in the market, you are inhibiting other companies' ability to participate in the market. And this is, that is the at its core, this is the story. If you are you've seen, maybe if you play games on your phone, mm-hmm. for example, and you saw the big battle that Apple had with Epic Games.
Right.
It's still going on, actually. They removed it from the platform because Epic Games had a way that you could buy stuff in-game that wasn't enriching Apple. And Apple's fees are like 30% of whatever you're charging. And so that ended up as a big lawsuit. And that, while Apple won that lawsuit here in the European Union, it didn't. And so it is getting to be, this lawsuit is going to be instrumental in how we feel about dominant companies. Even if a dominant company is making a product, I've got an iPhone in my pocket. I've got a MacBook out here in front of me. I love the functionality. And Apple would argue, hey, we've got this closed system because we make a super functional product. And generally speaking, I agree. So it's going to be very interesting, like, who is being harmed here and who is being helped.
So your statement earlier about how well the lawsuit was written, is that because they're trying to get in front of a judge that you need, that may not have a clear understanding of the technological aspects of this argument, and they're making it really clear for someone who's not a layman of technical intricacies?
I would say, one, it just happened. They happened to this. They got an attorney or attorneys that were good writers.
Okay.
I'd say two, they get a lot of translating that into a media story is much easier if the language is clear, if it's lucid.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't think from an expertise standpoint, I mean, I think a lot of the federal judges kind of know this stuff, and certainly they have clerks who really know this stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's more about that thing anybody in the public can read and actually get an understanding of what the government is arguing here. And at some point when Apple files its response, you'll be able to read that. My guess is it's probably going to be as clear as this one. But I think this is a super interesting story.
You think can you make any kind of prediction on it? What would you think?
Yeah.
If you were the judge on this bench.
They're going to settle at some point. It's going to take probably a year or two to work through the courts. Apple is going to have to back off on the games thing because it's already losing there in the EU. Apple's probably going to have to back off on the payments thing because it's kind of indefensible. Apple's probably going to win on some other stuff. And Apple's already said it's going to fix that messaging problem, which it created to keep people migrating from Android phones back onto iPhones. When I was younger, I used to switch back and forth all the time.
Did you?
Yeah, I liked it because there's things about Android phones that I really like. But once Apple started tightening the software, it got very difficult to be able to do that. Now, so I'm sort of one of those so-called victims, although I happen to like my iPhone.
You like what you got.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. Appreciate that, Mike. All right, coming up on the show, Steve Ballmer, we all know, but do you know his son? His son's a comedian, according to his son. We're gonna play some audio for you and let you be the judge. What's it like to grow up rich? Do you know anybody who did? Because I didn't, and I really don't. It's the Jack and Spike Show. I'm Mike Lewis sitting in. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Jack and Spike Show. Mike Lewis sitting in for Jack Stein today. Nora is on the producer's desk. Thank you, Nora, for helping out as well. I don't have any extremely wealthy friends. Growing up in a pretty modest blue-collar neighborhood mm-hmm. in Baltimore, Maryland, I went to school with some kids who really had money, but we weren't close.
Right.
I remember one time going to a guy's house who literally had an estate.
Right.
You know, had a servant. Servant's quarters.
Horses. The house had a name.
Something like that. Yeah, his great-grandfather was the Baron of whatever Mustine. How about you? Do you have any real rich friends growing up? Were you really rich?
No. We were very, very, very much on the other end of the spectrum. No. I mean, to the extent, the town I grew up in, Modesto, California, is not a super
coastal.
It's not a super wealthy town.
Okay.
But I went to the Catholic school there. So to the extent that, it's funny, like I had a girlfriend in high school who said, maybe this is just post high school. And we were talking about various friends and whatnot. She goes, it's funny, you know, because she grew up in a neighborhood as bad as the one I grew up in. And she said, you know, it's funny. All of your high school friends, all their families own businesses. And I never thought about it before. And I realized, like, all right, you know, even in this sort of small world we're in, those folks, and it, one of the businesses, and these were not close friends, but kids I went to school with, was Gallo Wine. So the Gallo kids, because they're the ones
That's money.
That's a lot of money. Yeah. And they are the ones who donated the land, because they're members of the church. They're the ones who donated the land where Central Catholic High School was built.
So we're talking about Steve Ballmer's son. Now, Steve Ballmer, you remember, of course, Microsoft CEO, guy who broke my heart when he bought the LA Clippers and did invest in NBA and returning NBA to Seattle.
Right.
Broke a lot of our hearts, Steve Ballmer. We thought he'd be the guy, much like Paul Allen was the guy for the Seahawks.
Totally.
So Pete Ballmer, by accounts, he did an interview with Business Insider. And by all accounts, the guy's done a nice job, and his parents have done a nice job of not raising an entitled, spoiled little
seems like a pretty reasonable guy.
And he, you know, he did go to college fully. His parents covered room and board and in his tuition. Not a lot of us have had that benefit. I didn't. I don't know if you didn't.
No.
Yeah. So he's not saddled with student debt, which is great. Came out of college and immediately took a job with a gaming company as a game developer. That's what he went to school for, which is nice. And inherited a bunch of money when his grandfather passed away. I say all that to say he still never, he didn't get jet skis for Christmas.
Right.
You know, he didn't drive to his to high school in a brand new Maserati or whatever on his 17th, 16th birthday.
Right.
His parents lived a pretty modest life. The Ballmers lived, his mom drove a Ford Fusion. You know, he got a ping pong table when Christmas was a highlight of his young life. So I wanted to bag on the guy for being a little rich kid, but he's overcome that and doing large part to a good job of parenting by the Ballmers, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what do they refer to that as? Is, you know, the irritation of folks who were born on third base
and think they hit a triple. Yes.
That's the problem sometimes, but he doesn't seem to be a part of that problem. And what little interaction I've had with Steve Ballmer, and I know a bunch of people who worked very closely with him, and one person who actually played a lot of basketball with him, and they used to have a fairly aggressive afternoon, midday pickup game at Microsoft for many, many years. And Ballmer's, obviously, it ended up, this was
big fan of the
two
game,
decades
big
before he bought a team. He always was about, and like, he was a intense guy, but kind of, as far as like his personal life went, kind of a reasonable man. Like, he wasn't somebody who was super ostentatious or wearing a $500,000 watch. He wasn't one of those guys.
So, Pete Ballmer is a stand-up comedian. Now, it's a privilege, and I think it's privileged to be able to have the financial security of your grandfather giving you $250,000 of Microsoft stock when you turn around. Let's play a quick little bit of Pete Ballmer's comedy.
Why are we trying to just make things easier for people who can afford Teslas? Doesn't that, like, it seems backwards that now you only get priority parking if you were either disabled or extremely abled. You know?
I like that.
That's not bad.
That's not bad at
all.
So if he comes to town, maybe we'll try to go see him or even have him on.
Yeah.
Way to go, Pete Ballmer. Way to go, Steve Ballmer, for raising what seems like a pretty semi-normal guy in a world
for being a billionaire, a multi-billionaire's kid.
Amen. Okay, coming up next hour on the Jack and Spike Show, we're going to talk a little bit about some local news that happened over the weekend, yesterday. God, it feels like a Monday because it's you're here now and it's a whole different world when you're sitting with Mike Lewis and Jack's taking a day off today. The Seattle City Council pushing forward a rollback of delivery driver minimum wage. And Burien raising the minimum wage. But many people won't see a bump. They've carved out quite a few occupations that won't be affected by this minimum wage in Burien.
Right.
We'll have more of that when we come back right after these.